Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I am your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as I am joined by Ray Christian, and he is representing both Soiree, which is a online community group and instruction forum and support center for those who choose to do superheroic doses of mushrooms, and he is also the host of the Psychedelic Diaries Podcast. We spoke a few weeks ago and had a great conversation, and I'm happy to bring that to you today. As I mentioned in last week's podcast episode, I'm actually currently away from home, so I'm recording this early. So if you have made a donation in support of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast over the past couple of weeks, I'll, of course, thank you after I get back home and upload a new episode. But for now, if you would like to support this podcast, it's quite easy. Go by my personal webpage at martinball.net. You can use the PayPal link at the top right of the page or the link over to my Patreon page where you can sign up as a monthly supporter at the level that you are comfortable with of your choice, anywhere from $1 a month up to $100 a month. And at that top level, you get an 1 hour monthly consult call check-in with me to talk about whatever's going on with you or whatever's on your mind. And speaking of such things, of course, I'm always available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations to help you integrate your psychedelic experience. You can find out more at nondualentheogenicintegration.com. Well, since I'm recording this early and don't really have anything to bring you up to date on, we can go ahead and get right into the conversation with Ray. You can find out more about Ray and Soiree and the Psychedelic Diaries podcast at soiree.com. And it's a little tricky because it's a play on the French word for evening party. And it has a P in the front for like psilocybin. So psoiree.com, soiree.com. Here's my conversation with Ray. Hope you enjoy. Be back next week with another selection from the Entheological Paradigm 2021 edition, and then another interview after that. And by that point, I'll be back home, so I'll be all up to date on my announcements and stuff, okay? All right, cool. Here's the interview with Ray. So my guest today on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast is going to have to go for an exceptionally long period of time when we compare it to his little micro podcast, which we're going to talk about, is Ray Christian. And he is the host of the Psychedelic Diaries podcast, which I was looking at, and like your episodes are like 1 and 2 minutes long. And I'm thinking like, oh my God, how does he do that? So we'll have to talk about that. And also, I forget what your title was, but I know you're involved with Soiree. It's a little bit of a pun there on the French word for evening party, but it's with a P, and it's about large doses, super heroic doses of psilocybin mushrooms, and you've got like a whole community and a whole instructional everything. So we're gonna talk all about it. But Ray, welcome to the podcast.
Martin, what an introduction! Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I always like to start by just kind of getting to know my guests, unless I already know them, which, you know, happens on the podcast. But you, I don't know, we've just met and we've both been discussing some issues around sleep here that we're not including in the podcast. But for those of you with sleep problems out there, just know you're not alone. But Ray, I'm interested in hearing, how did you get into the world of psychedelics? And then we got to get into this super heroic doses and get into your podcast. But let's get a little bit of your backstory. Where do you come from? How did you get into this?
The psychedelic origin story. So I think like a lot of people, I started out with recreational and just a few times though, at 18, 19, high school, college. And then I didn't touch it or even think about it for a decade plus. And fast forward, I'm in my early 30s and I'm in this posh LA club and where I currently live. And I had a crush on this girl and like she was a knockout. And I had high hopes of, you know, dreams of what I could pull off and future with her. And in walks her boyfriend that I just met for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him for about 5 minutes and I wanted to really dislike him, and I kind of did at first, and then I realized, wow, I am completely outclassed. And before I could really process the hit to my ego, he reaches in his pocket and hands me magic mushrooms in the middle of a club. And at first I'm thinking, who does that? Who is this guy? And soon after I heard that this girl that I had a crush on was also engaging with psychedelics with him, and kind of in a misguided effort to keep up with the Joneses, I started on a hunt to see, try to find some. Mm. It's not that easy to find them. This is 6 years ago. And I did. And so I basically ostensibly did it as another recreational dose. I got a couple friends together and we did a dose. And then maybe a few months later, we tried to do it again because it was fun. And we did a half dose, about 1.75 grams. And then probably the second or third time, just by sheer accident, we did a big dose this time. We said, all right, let's do 3.5. And just by sheer luck, I veered off on my own into a room. And usually you're giggling together, the fractals and the visual absurdity and all that. And I veered off into a room by myself and just laid down, stopped doing anything, and just went inwards. Mm. And that experience changed everything.
Yeah.
It sounds crazy, but I met God. And I realized that gratitude is now my religion. And it changed me in all these fundamental but subtle but beautiful ways. And I said, more of this. I want to see more of this. And fast forward to this, I've kind of turned into like a 1940s scientist experimenting on myself because I didn't even think to research because I was like, it's illegal and no one's going to really post about it. And I started doing what I now know Sasha Shulgin had been doing, which is once a month, large doses, and doing a practice on my own. Mm-hmm. And mostly solo, oftentimes with a friend or two, or maybe got kind of guiding people, although I'm not a guide. And it just blossomed into this beautiful thing. My career changed. My health got better. I was better at relationships with family. And I'm just incredibly grateful for the whole experience.
Yeah. And I like this element of your story of kind of the shift from the more social interaction, which I always like to say, I think is a completely valid use of psychedelics that, you know, for entertainment, for socializing, for, you know, enjoying time with other people or being out in nature or a concert or festival. I think that's totally legitimate, but it's very different than I'm just focusing on my inward experience. I'm not trying to socialize. And that this is one of the key factors that I like to identify as providing the opportunity to really go beyond the ego. Because as long as we're socializing, we are maintaining subject-object duality, right? That we're maintaining my identity is interacting with this other person's identity. But when we give that opportunity to say, okay, well I'm just going to deal with myself now, that, you know, anybody who listens to my podcast is not going to be surprised by the phrase, well, I met God, you know, that's a normal occurrence here on the podcast, so don't feel out of place at all. But that's often what it takes, that the socializing aspect can get in the way of these deeper realizations, which again, is not to criticize them. It's just to remark that the context and the situation that you're putting yourself in makes a big impact on where you go within these experiences. And the inner focusing is very different from the outer focusing.
That's beautifully put. And the concept of the subject object duality can be tricky. I've always thought that they're like the one-on-one or with a friend or even in nature, that's unique. And there's something there that you don't get on the solo trip or the inward trip, or vice versa. And I've found one of the things I had to start doing because of exactly like you said, when you're interacting, it's almost like whether subconsciously or consciously, you're kind of thinking, what am I doing with my face? What am I doing with my arms? Is my tone good and sounding cool? And when I started doing it with other people in the room and we were both trying to go inwards, even though we're in the same room, because some people just feel safer with someone else, obviously. I had to start telling people beforehand. I was like, look, do not seek out or expect eye contact because I'm not going to give it to you.
Yeah.
And that helped a lot because I don't want to figure out what to do with my mouth and think about words and things and stuff because I can pull from it sometimes.
Yeah. It actually reminds me of back when I was facilitating one-on-one 5-MeO sessions with people. And that was a big part, is actually watching people's faces. And where, you know, you get someone, so this is only audio, so they can't see this on the podcast. But, you know, when someone is like going into this transcendental state, you can see on their face, they're like, oh, and then you can see the ego literally snap back in. All of a sudden they're like, oh, and they make an expression on their face that you can tell, okay, now you're trying to communicate to someone outside of yourself. So you've just shifted from being completely absorbed in your experience to now you're focusing on, what do I look like? What am I communicating through this facial expression? And it reminds me a little bit, it's actually been quite a while since I've done like any big work with mushrooms, but that was where I started, was with psilocybin mushrooms in terms of, well, started with cannabis, but then got onto psilocybin mushrooms when I was like 18, I think. And what I learned really quickly, that one of my personal rules was, I'm not going to talk to anyone unless there is something that I feel I absolutely must say. And I didn't even think about it in terms of, reducing the propensity of the ego to interact or socialize. But that's actually what it was, that this kind of internal, like, I'm just not going to, and I would tell people that I was tripping with, like, okay, I'm not going to talk to you. Okay. And don't talk to me. But if I feel right, there's something I need to share, I will. But that was a way for me to kind of minimize that, even in a social setting, and kind of similar to like the eye contact that you're discussing.
Yeah. It's a good frame for people going into it. It's almost like, I agree with that. Also with cannabis too, I found sometimes I think it's good to have like an incubation period.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's like, if I take a bowl hit, I'm not a huge smoker, but a few times a week, I do enjoy it. And sometimes if I take a bowl hit or a bong hit, I like maybe 10, 20 minutes of just, don't make me say stuff. Let me just let the body adjust to this new, state that I'm in. And one of the things I would say on these trips, I would set up a little pillow nest for each person. And I would say, look, we're both, you're going to have noises. You're going to hear, we're going to hear each other. And we may see each other in some way, but think of us like we are on an interstellar trip, Matthew McConaughey style. Yeah. We're not going to be able to interact. You may fly into the gargantuan black hole. We can hear each other, but we're not going to be able to see each other. So don't expect that. And that framing, it helped me. And I think it helps other people as well to know that, okay, I don't have to do stuff with my face or words.
Yeah. Yeah. That there's so much pressure that gets built into that of, oh, how am I presenting to this other person, and giving people that freedom to, don't worry about it. Just, yeah. So that's kind of one of my cardinal rules of, if you're working with psychedelics with the intention of personal transformation, liberation, healing, whatever, however we want to characterize it, that one of my cardinal rules is, minimize all social interactions to the bare minimum of what is necessary during the time period that you are deepest in the medicine experience. And that socializing is something that could be done afterwards. And especially narrating your experience is something that should happen afterwards. But when you're in it, only communicate with others if you absolutely need to. And then other than that, just keep coming back to your own experience. So I'd like to ask you,
totally agree,
in this pivotal experience of experiencing God, what would you describe as your background prior to that? Because this is a common event in the psychedelic world of people experiencing some form of divinity, unitary consciousness, divine love, often for people who don't come from either a religious or a spiritual background. So I'm wondering how you would describe yourself before, during, and after.
So I grew up Catholic. It was force fed on me. I was in a Catholic school all the way through 12th grade. And even up till like 22, 23, I was still like making deals with God and, still pondering hell and what if I lied and had out of wedlock sex. And then I had some sort of awakening where I realized that ain't it.
Yeah.
Something there doesn't feel right. And so that led to basically a 10-year period or 11 or 12 of just utter agnosticism. Maybe not totally atheism where I'm like, all is nothing, but I was like, religion is not for me at all. But I still held out this idea that maybe there's something bigger that's there, and kind of identified as a little bit of Buddhism or a little bit of a Buddhist, mm-hmm, and some of the precepts there, but I would even say the secular side of Buddhism, the meditation. And so that was the lead-in. So I kind of was religious, lost the religion, and then I had that experience. And there's two ways I can try to describe it. As you know, it gets tough to put words to this stuff, but it's the first way is it's like one of those like diagrams or like one of those cool YouTube videos where they're like, here's the Earth. Here's Earth compared to the sun. Here's the sun compared to the biggest sun compared to the biggest black hole. So in that, it was, I was like some ball of energy. I don't know how to, I was a ball of light or energy in some three-dimensional space. And I encountered this other ball of energy that was, it was like I was Earth and it was the biggest black hole that we know of.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh my God. Oh my God. It's so big. It's, I can't even, big doesn't even do it justice. It was so humbling. And at the same time, the other thing that I felt was, Martin, it was like if you've ever had a dog or a cat, especially a smart one, there's a moment or there are moments where, especially in their later years, they'll just look at you and you're trying to say something or do something and they just want to know what you're saying. And it's just the thing you're not going to be able to communicate. Like, why we have to go to the vet today, Fido, or whatever it is. And you just, you can't, you love them so much, and you, but you can't communicate. So instead, you kind of shower them with love. And in that scenario, I felt like the dog. Where I was like completely checked. I was completely like outclassed. I sensed that there was things I couldn't understand. But I just, I felt this like just overwhelming love from this entity. And also the size of it, both at the same time. And it kind of left me with this strange concept of gratitude is my religion, or gratitude is the God in a way, or some sort of, or gratitude is this like high abstraction of true attraction or consciousness. And so that changed me. And that has since, gratitude has become since my mantra. It's changed everything I do. I think gratitude is, in a way, it's like the secret handshake for interdimensional travel, or even 3D travel. If you show up with a sense of, hey, thanks for being alive and doing whatever you're doing, entity, it's a good thing. And I've since become, I'm in that camp of spiritual but not religious now.
Yeah.
Where, and I just read a book called Journey of Souls, which just blew my mind and also really resonated with some things that I've seen on deep trips. So now I feel like there is an afterlife and something elegant, something that makes sense and meaningful. And then that brings a lot of meaning to my life now, actually.
So I'm curious, in the event itself, did you come out of the room and did you say, go to your friends like, hey, I think I just encountered God? And, or did you keep it to yourself? I mean, obviously now you're at the point of, you're a sharer, right? You've got your podcast, you've got Soiree, so you're into sharing. But I'm curious, how did you feel at that time about, can I share this? What should I share? And if you did, how was it received?
So what happened was, we ended up getting 3.5 grams, and it was by request. We got a really cap heavy 3.5 grams. It's the first time I'd done that much, and also cap heavy. And so so one guy did the same amount with me. He was a business partner, kind of a brother at the time, and one other guy that did half the amount. And so I walked out, and to your point, I was like, something not chill just happened, guys. I just met God. I literally said that, and they're like, and the one guy who had done half the dose was like, okay, more shtick from Ray or whatever. And, but the other guy who was like, yeah, I died for about 10 minutes. I was convinced that I was dead. And, which we now know was ego death. We were very untrained at that point as to what we were doing. But, I literally said, I met God, guys. And, you know, I don't know how well it landed at the time, but certainly said it.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of similar for me with after my first full 5-MeO-DMT experience. I'd actually recently just left my wife and partner for 16 years and had moved away. And, you know, we were still on good terms. And so the very next day I called her up and I was like, you know, I just got to tell you that I died and I experienced God last night. And it's completely changed my perspective on everything. And she was just kind of like, oh, great. Thanks for sharing. She didn't really know what to make of it. But yeah, it's like I had to tell people that was my feeling. And also, I've got to tell the people close to me. Even though it was the wife that I had left, that, you know, she was still close. So it was like, I've got to tell her, like, this is the mother of our children. I've got to tell her that I've just experienced God.
It's such a good point. And I think a lot of us psychonauts struggle with that exact experience that you articulated in Jim Fadiman's Psychedelic Explorers book. He said his one sentence, he's like, one of the important things to know is nobody's going to care about your transcendent experience. And that's a tough pill to swallow. And it sounds like she was kind of like, hey, that's neat, Martin. And
yeah,
I got that too. And I went, I said that to the guys I was doing it with on the trip. And then in the weeks and months, maybe even a couple of years afterwards, I was still kind of like, I want to shout this from the mountaintops, like Ron Burgundy. And I soon realized slowly but surely that, like, no, people aren't that interested. You still have to show up and say, hey, how are you? How was your day?
Yeah.
Okay. And then maybe 5 or 50 turns of conversation, then you can get to it. And it's kind of tough it's a tough pill to swallow to realize people aren't really that interested if they don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I developed the protocol is, if people ask about it, then answer. But don't bring the plate of, hey, I want to tell you all about this. And so, you know, that's why, you know, for me, the plate is sort of the podcast, my books, things like that. It's like, I make this information available, but I don't want to push it on anyone. I don't want to be like, you know, too much shoving it in people's faces, you know.
Yeah, it's well put. It's funny. I was trying to get people to do it for a couple of years afterwards in a misguided attempt to spread the word. And,
yeah.
And the minute I stopped trying and instead kind of, like you said, built these plates, like you, the podcast in your book, I started the podcast, and then actually TikTok, I started engaging, taking some of the clips, putting them there and engaging with the audience, and really just kind of, I treated it as my own personal documentary. And it was when I just told my story to myself in a way, that's when it started to impact people. And it was just a funny little counterintuitive paradox, or just a counterintuitive point, where the more you try to push it on people, the more they don't want to do it. If you just talk and be an example, maybe then they'll come and ask about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that arouses curiosity in people, like, oh, well, this is interesting, and it's not being forced on me. So let's go ahead and let's talk about that transition, because, you know, not everybody who has a big, powerful experience with mushrooms and then gets into regular work with them then goes on to create an online community, or, you know, start something on TikTok or start a podcast. So how did you make that decision of, I want to share about this publicly? Not only am I doing this privately, but I want to be a public person that's part of the public face of psychedelics.
So it was somewhat self-serving, if I'm being honest. The backstory was, I built a tech company with some brilliant people. We launched an app, sold it, built this AI technology for mental health. And it looked like we were about to make the Zuckerberg leap. And then, I won't get into the whole saga, but it went into the full Joseph Campbell void, hero's journey void, and realized I need to shutter this company and move on to the next thing. And as I did, I realized, if I could just wave a magic wand, what would I do? And for me, it was obvious. It was psychedelics. But I kind of thought, no way, it's illegal. But when I started poking around, I realized, oh my goodness, this industry is actually materializing.
Yeah.
There's some funding and commercialization and legalization changes. And so, to go back in the story just a little bit, I'd been a radio show co-host in LA that helped promote the app that we sold eventually. And so I knew how to flap my gums a little bit. And I said, well, I could do that again. I was the co-host, not the host. I did kind of color commentary, but I was like, I could probably be a little bit of the host. And but we really put it over the edge. It was one of my mentors was like, Ray, yes, you've been doing a lot of work on your own, but nobody knows that. It's like you in your living room. Nobody knows that. You're not a name in psychedelics by any means. He said, start a podcast specifically as a networking tool. And that was what triggered it for me. I was like, yeah, he's right. And it turns out it's true. It's an astounding networking tool. It is very difficult to say, hey, Martin, can I jump on a call? Let's talk business and let's figure out a way to do something, versus, hey, would you like to jump on my podcast?
Yeah.
And it's funny for me, the show's 30 minutes long, which is about the same as a call would be anyways. It's on Zoom, which is the same as a call anyways. And yet that slight change, I was able to get Jim Fadiman, Dennis McKenna, all these like really fun luminaries. And so then it turned into
beyond just the self-serving trying to network, I also wanted to help the industry and kind of keep some people honest, because, call out some bad, not actors, but bad actions perhaps, and just kind of make a name for myself a little bit. And so I did, and I started off with, it's only been a year, and I started, and it's every episode got a little bit better, and here we are.
Yeah, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with being self-serving. I mean, we are individuals that need to care for ourselves, and, especially in the very atomized kind of society that we live in, where we're not living with extended family, or we're not living in, the same yes. village our entire lives. We all have to go out and make a career for ourselves and all of that. That I think that there's nothing wrong with being self-serving. And if it's doing something that you think is fun and you think is interesting, nothing wrong with that.
I appreciate that. And yeah, at the end of the day, if you do what you love, you're probably going to be good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you have, were you nervous at all about, okay, well, I'm going to kind of come out of the psychedelic closet, going to start being public about this? Did you have concerns at that level?
Yes, absolutely. And so we were in mental health in my prior company, Texpert, and we had in some articles we would do little blogs. I would allude to it, and I'd say, oh, psychedelic therapy, there might be something there, but I never fully came out of it. And how many people were really reading our blog on our company page? So when I realized, if I'm gonna do this right, I have to be loud. And it was hard. And it's funny you say that. I use the same phrasing, coming out of the psychedelic closet, because that's how it feels. Where ain't no going back in. Like, once that cat's out of the bag, it's out. And so there's just some jobs I'm never going to get now. And I had to come to grips with that. But what put me over the edge was I realized I'm sick of, this is so important and so beautiful and so life-changing, and we've been lied to for so long about it, that someone needs to come out and raise their hand, kind of like Bill Maher did in the 90s. And I don't have nearly his impact or clout, but somebody needs to. And the other thought I had was, God bless the hippies, but I'm not a hippie. And there is a connotation that if you do psychedelics, you turn into like a flower wearing, muumuu wearing, multi-ear pierced hippie. And that's just not me. I'm a professional, I'm a business guy. And I was like, look, maybe I can be one of those voices showing people that psychedelics not only don't turn you from what you are now, if you don't want to, they can make you better at it. Because I'm convinced it has made me smarter, better, wiser, faster as a business person. And so I was like, for those two reasons, I need to come out. And literally posted on LinkedIn and got the knot in my stomach and saying, here's what I'm doing, here's the post. And and then two things happened. One, it was just freeing to know that I'm not going to get certain jobs, but I'm also not going to end up in the wrong job.
Yeah.
Where, because there's already a natural filter built in. So that's kind of comforting, and the truth will set you free kind of concept. And then the second thing that happened was, especially in the TikTok, people would say, I'm now growing because of you, or I'm doing my first big dose because of you. And after, we talked about the first couple of years of trying to bang on doors, get people to try it and getting slapped in the face, to see that was just so meaningful.
Cool. Well, let me ask you a little bit about TikTok. So this is one of these social media apps that I've never used. I've never looked at. I don't have anything to do with it. And even Facebook. So I use Facebook as social media, and that was something where prior to that, I was using, what was it called? MySpace. Yeah, I was posting my music and stuff on MySpace, and I liked that you could upload your music and make it available there. And then everyone was like, oh, you should have a page on Facebook. And I was like, I don't want more social media. But then I eventually went to Facebook, and so I used that. And in the past couple of years, I opened up an Instagram account just where I can post photographs and art. But I'm not a big social media user. And I tend to avoid my Facebook feed because, I get a lot of friend requests from people whose views I might not exactly align with. And so sometimes I'm scrolling through the feed. It's like, my God, really? Really? So I'm not big on it. But TikTok, what have you found to be valuable about TikTok? And again, I'm fairly ignorant about TikTok. All I know about is that like young people post lots of dances of themselves on TikTok. So what's TikTok for you, and how has that served your capacity to reach an audience?
So it's well put, and I appreciate that share about hesitance. I was hesitant, and full caveat, I acknowledge that ultimately it's a drug of some sort. It's a digital drug, and I acknowledge I'm perhaps a little bit addicted, and I'm getting the dopamine hits, and so yeah. Just put that out there. It's true. And it's another thing you have to try to manage because it can get out of hand and you're scrolling and liking. But I'll say this, I was really hesitant to do another social media because we got our Instagram account from that previous company I mentioned to a significant level and like 40,000 or something. We sold it and it helped a lot of the stuff we did. So I saw the value on it, the ability to truly add business value. But I was like, okay, my career as an influencer, whatever, you know, a poster is done. I'm too old for this. And that same mentor, advisor, friend of mine was like, look, Ray, you're not Joe Rogan. You're never going to be. Get these down to clips that are bite-sized because most people probably won't listen to your whole episode and post them on TikTok. And I was like, TikTok, I don't want to do another fucking social media. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this, but.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I did. And I had the conception of this connotation of, yes, it's for kids dancing. And it certainly is that there is that there, but that's not all it is. Far from it. Now that's just perhaps a fraction of it. And I'm a little bit right now. I'm having a little bit of a dance with TikTok because they just banned me from running ads for a little bit, or permanently, as they say. So I'm a little bit peeved at the moment. But the headline is, it's a brilliant app. It's an astounding feat of engineering, design, and community building, and especially for the consciousness raising community. And their algorithm is exquisite. And if you are going to do it, Martin, the way I would recommend, or for anyone listening that's considering, is just go on and post a bunch of crap. Don't overthink it. Just post a bunch of crap for a few weeks. And also critically, don't try to add any friends. Don't tell any friend you're on there. Just go and post. And it will find who likes you. And it took a while, but it started really connecting me with people that I've become true friends with that I would have never otherwise met.
Yeah.
And I'm actually moving to Medellin because of a big 9-gram trip I just did. And not to get too off topic, but I met someone who's in Medellin through that, and we just connected. And she's a designer. So all these connections come. And the really fun part is there's something about TikTok where, Martin, you can't fake the funk. Like, it's you with your face, and you can't do touch-ups and all this BS. And especially when you do the lives, once you get to about 1,000 people, you can do lives. And the lives were really foundational for me because it gave me a chance to tell my story, my harm reduction story of I've done a lot of solo work. And when I talked about that with other psychedelic experts in the industry, I kind of felt like a pariah because they're like, how dare you? You have to have a guide and you have to go to a retreat. And
yeah.
I just never had that. And so I said, look, in the name of harm reduction, I'm going to talk about that. And Martin, on these lives, people came out of the woodwork saying, me too. I have some. I used it. I've had these trips. And I've done big doses solo. And that's what led to eventually soiree. But what those lives ended up being, and really the posts and the interactions in the comment section, was this really in-depth user research experiment. Learning about the user, learning about these people that are engaging now. And there's 30 million of us at least in the U.S. And this was a way to connect to them. So for that, I'm eternally grateful for TikTok.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a good way to connect with people who could really vibe in with what you were sharing and your position. And that is interesting that there is something of a psychedelic establishment, which I just think is a little bit ironic to use that term, but there is sort of this idea of if you're not doing it according to these prescribed methods that somehow you're being dangerous or you're being unsafe. And like, this was a major issue for, I don't know if you're familiar with Kalindi Iyi. Mm-mm. Okay. Well, Kalindi, he died a couple years ago, but he was someone who really pushed the envelope with psilocybin. And his whole thing was, yeah, work your way up to 40 grams and do it on your own. And he's someone that I had brought out to Ashland a few different times to come and speak. And, you know, we hung out a few different times. And one of the things he would tell me is like, yeah, you know, I might get invited to give a talk somewhere. And then I come and I tell them what I do. And then I never get invited back because everyone says that I'm being irresponsible and I'm giving people, you know, dangerous information. Right. And his attitude was, I don't want this to be anybody's domain, that they have control over how someone can, if you're comfortable taking 40 grams on your own and you feel that you're safe and responsible, that's your choice. And you don't need people telling you, no, you've got to have a therapist, you've got to have a sitter, you've got to have an integration specialist. That he was just into exploration. That was his deal. And he was very gung-ho about it. And he also said, yeah, it can be terrifying, but this is what's interesting for me.
Yeah. Wow. I did not know about him. I've never heard that story. And I appreciate, it's like sometimes you got to go too far to know where the line is. You got to cross the line sometimes. And I love that he was like, no, 40 grams. I've never heard that amount. I mean, 9, you know, blew my wig off. But I think they're... That, yeah, it's nobody's domain. And also it's like, it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic class is, what your racial profile is, what your political orientation, white, black, orange, brown, yellow, doesn't matter. Nobody has authority, autonomy over these. They have been here for thousands, millions of years, perhaps way before we got here. It doesn't matter who found them. They're nobody's domain. Yeah. And there shouldn't be any gatekeeping on this. And for me, like I've tested it with other friends and kind of tried to track back on my own experience. And I think that my best guess is that at about your fifth larger dose with maybe even just a friend, you're probably ready to go solo. I think that's when I was. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing the blowback you get when you talk to people about solo work or these really large doses. And it feels like more gatekeeping, and that's not what we need here in psychedelics.
Yeah. I've definitely encountered the same thing where, you know, what I have focused on the most since 2008 has been 5-MeO-DMT. And there, my advice has always been to people, ideally, I would like you to be served 5-MeO initially by someone who really knows what they're doing and is really familiar with all the different ways that people react to this incredibly powerful molecule. And then once you've had a few sessions and you know, okay, this is how I'm going to react, this is what my experience is, then I say, yeah, then it's generally safe to work with on your own. I don't really see that as an issue. And this is another one where sometimes people are, no, you must always have a sitter. You need to have medical personnel on hand. It's like, it's overkill. That's not true. That it's promoting a false idea of what is safe versus what is not safe.
It's like there's it's like the person, the medical community, to me, God bless them, obviously. But for me, it's like the problem with the medical community and psychedelics is the same thing as the guy walking around with a hammer. Everything starts to look like a nail.
Yeah.
And it's like with these compounds, they do heal. And that's great. And that's important for people that are mentally ill or have any number of conditions to get to baseline, and it helps people that are at baseline maybe optimize or do preventative. But the challenge is, and the part that's hard to communicate to them, is that to the healthy but dissatisfied, or the person that's on a hunt for purpose or more than they're already healthy, it's so much more than a medicine. For my money, it is a portal.
Yeah.
And what you see in that portal fundamentally changes your nature of the way you see reality and the nature of your existence. And that the significance of that dwarfs the significance of medical assays, clinical trials. And that's just not something that the doctors and healthcare professionals like to hear, but that's the simple fact if you talk to other psychonauts.
Yeah, yeah. That there's so many ways that we can engage with these things in our lives that is meaningful and personally rewarding. And it doesn't always have to fit a particular medical or therapeutic model or specific structure. That there's plenty of room for experimentation and individual choice, I think.
It's like one quick thought, if I may.
Yeah.
there's something about psychedelics that seem to, it's almost like every aspect of it, the more you dig in, the more you hit some paradoxical asymptote where it's just, it's not going to be pinned down, okay?
Yeah.
No matter how much you want, whether it's, what is this? What is it? Is it a medicine? Is it a portal? Is it a recreational? Good luck pinning it down. What happened on my experience? Did I go somewhere? Was I here? Was it, good luck pinning it down? It's like it refuses to be pinned down.
Yeah. So let's pin down. How often do you do your podcast? Like, what's your schedule with the putting out episodes? And I think you said you've been doing about a year now.
So I did it about a year, and once a week was the cadence. And now I'm actually at a point where I'm considering doing a Larry David Curb Your Enthusiasm style break. And because it's taking up a lot of time and the soiree is starting to take off a little bit. And so what I think I may do is, so I've already just transitioned it to once every 2 weeks. And I think what I'll do is probably maybe go down to once a month. Either way, I'm going to take a break for a little bit because it's, you know, non-trivial. As you know, this is a lot of work. People don't see that. The prep, the post, it's just a lot. So once a week to kind of get the cadence, and then now taking a little break.
Yeah, I think it's good to pace yourself. I mean, I've been doing this since 2008 is when I started the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. And initially when I started, you know, I've always liked doing long interviews. But when I first started, what I would do is I would break every interview into two parts. So like, here's 45 minutes 1 week, next week, here's another 45 minutes. And then there was a period where I didn't do any interviews and I just did a lot of monologues. And then I took some time period off where I didn't do anything. And then I got back to doing weekly podcasts and interviews. And then I started organizing events here in Ashland. And that turned to be really great for the podcast because I would organize events and I would record people's talks and then put those out on the podcast, which made it a lot easier than finding someone new to interview every week, read their book, go through their materials. I mean, especially when you have an author, you know, it's a lot. I mean, it takes hours to read somebody's book. It can take days and just prepping for an interview and wanting to be able to converse with them about this is what you wrote and like show them that respect. You know, I'm an author, but I have a lot of materials available so that people can kind of get to know what I like to talk about without reading all my books. But I've certainly had interviews where someone has like had no exposure to my books or anything like that, and then it's just kind of awkward, like, okay, so what do you do? And like, well, you could read the book, or you know. But it takes a lot of time and a lot of work to put together a podcast, so it's always interesting to see how people manage that. And like right now I'm doing an interview every other week, and then since I've made, I think I've done like 10 audiobooks for my books at this point that I release chapters from my audiobooks in between interviews just to give myself more time and more space in between interviews.
I like that cadence of every other week. I think that's wise. And let me just say, Martin, thank you for what you're doing. There's a lot of people now that you could say, oh, they're trailblazing, they're coming out of the closet now. And God bless everybody in the psychedelic industry, quite frankly. But in 08, you were doing this. Like, you were truly tip of the spear leading the way. So it's a great show. And I think your following is a good attestation to that. So thank you for what you're doing. You really have changed in a world of butterfly effects and ripple effects. You've changed a lot of us. So thank you.
Oh, well, thanks, Ray. I appreciate that. Well, let's pivot and let's talk about soiree. And this obviously seems like another fairly large jump from, okay, you're doing your solo work, you're sharing large dose experiences with friends and acquaintances, but then actually putting together like this online community with resources for how to do large dose psilocybin journeys, how to navigate, how to integrate, how to connect with others who are doing this kind of work. That's a big leap. So what inspired that move into creating soiree? And just for the listening audience, so it's psoiree.com. And so you put a little P in there for your psilocybin. And soiree, of course, is French for like evening parties. I don't remember much French from high school, but I do remember soiree. So yeah, so how did it come about to like, this is what I'm going to do?
So it was the TikTok lives that did it. essentially I would get up and just talk and tell my story. And then all these people were interacting with me. Sometimes I would get another viewer on there. And I heard, so I had an experience, I have experience as a kind of a design research, tech research. I've had experience doing that. And so I was starting to talk to these users and interacting with them. It's almost like a focus group in some ways. So I was like, what challenges are you guys running into? And I kept hearing two things over and over. One was dialogue. They want dialogue. And it's kind of like what you and I were talking about. You want to talk, you called your ex-wife and told her, you know, about your experience. And so that was one thing. And the second thing was that they wanted some tips and advice, but not a lot. So if I started waxing eloquent of all these steps and stuff, I lost them. But they would say, look, just give me some tips and general tips. And so those two things stuck with me. Just they want dialogue with other explorers, and they want a little bit of advice. They're not going to take a 10-hour course, not in today's, you know, attention economy. And so I thought to myself, and then I was like, well, okay, this is illegal, obviously, and these people are doing it on their own. I can't sell them the product. I can't, I don't want to be an official guide. I don't want to do anything illegal. I was like, how can I go up to the, get to the illegality, right up to it, and then go right around it and just kind of sandwich the illegality of it without actually crossing the line? And it took some noodling to really get it right, but I was like, a community, a harm reduction community. Mm-hmm. And so that was the impetus where I said, some place to connect them where it's, I wanted something that could do two things. One, it was scalable and it wouldn't need me there being like the engine conductor, and helpful in this space, because right now there is an unserved audience of active psychedelic users and that are never going to go get a prescription and that may not ever go to Peru for an ayahuasca visit and may never go to a ketamine clinic. There's a lot of them and they're unserved. And so the idea was a digital community, and I had this TikTok as a funnel where it's like people are going into my profile page. What do I do here? I like this guy and I like this idea. What do I do? And I got, we got kind of good at that in the previous company. So I said, okay, I got, you know, build a funnel, get them to click here, then they sign up maybe. And so it took some iteration and design, but we got it to a point where we would invite people. We try to make it very cost effective and accessible. And so it was that process of just trying to bring a community for the people that are, that want to talk about it and don't have a place to do so.
And I'm just scrolling through the main page here, and it's just a nice clean website. And you've got partners,
you.
Peace of mind. We have prepare for liftoff, ace the landing, mushroom growing. And if you're dissatisfied, hungry for purpose, ready to optimize the mind, then you came to the right place. And you have list of benefits. We have the solo PDF, the dojo, the find a wingman, dialogue without stigma, integrate a new path, bonus perks, start exploring. So you've got, and so this is a membership based website. And I think, yeah, and this is, you scroll down to the bottom and like, what? 200% refund. If you're unhappy with Soiree, we'll refund your purchase two times. Get started. So even
that was really enjoyable, by the way, after designing every single step of that to have you walk through. That was very satisfying. Thank you for that.
Oh, nice. Well, it's, you know, I like the presentation. And even making the decision, okay, this is going to be a membership based community. Was that a difficult decision to make, or was it like, okay, let's just monetize it? I mean, cause that's one of the, it's one of these tricky things in the psychedelic world of monetizing information, monetizing experience, monetizing therapy. It's an issue that comes up a lot. And some people, which I disagree with, is like, everything's got to be free. And that's kind of the modern internet attitude, is like, everything should be available for free. And like, even with my own podcast, you know, I've been doing it for years and I ask people for donations, and I've had people over the years say, oh, well, you really should make it subscription based, you know, if you want to make money off of it. And it's like, well, but I don't want to do that. I just want to make, because that's like more work for me to make it subscription based. I'd rather just do it, put it out there. Whoever finds it, whatever. But I'm just curious in terms of your own idea of making it a business in that sense, of that you're joining up as a member, and then these are all the benefits that you're getting. Was that a hard decision for you, or was it a no-brainer? And it kind of goes back to the question of, we all do need to be self-serving to some degree. Mm-hmm. And part of that is making money so that we can survive and pay the bills and eat, and then hopefully make more possibilities possible, that money makes things possible. I mean, it's just the truth of the monetary economy that we live in. So what are your thoughts and feelings about all of that?
Well, thank you for the tactful way that you asked that question. It was a struggle, because it is something that's, you know, when you're in the space of purpose and in a way kind of spirituality, you want to be just like, here, take it all, and just be like a contributor to the earth. But
yeah,
what we found was, at the end of the day, we built a free product. The app we ended up selling, it was free to sign up, and it was great, and I loved it. But I remember thinking, I wish we had just tried it to see if people would pay for it, because it ends up being a litmus test. It's like a stress test to see, is a product really that good? And so that was one takeaway that was always in the back of my mind. Second thing is, we do get vitriol on our TikTok. Sometimes the occasional commenter will troll and say,
yeah,
you guys are monetizing mushrooms. How dare you? How dare you? The gall. And my response lately has just been like, you know, I have bills too. And I have rent. And like, I'm not here to work for free for everybody. I'm not living on a Buddhist monastery. And so it's okay to ask for money. I think even in psychedelics, you know, in the extremes, it can be bad. If you're, you know, I think there are some players that need to get, slapped on the wrist in psychedelics. But ultimately, even in this space, if you're providing value and you're helping people, it's okay to charge and to make money, especially when you're really adding value to their lives. And then the final thought was, at the end of the day, this is a highly personal situation. The fact that I'm tripping, the fact that I do these journeys, when I do them, how I do them. And so to make this membership based and have a little bit of a barrier, it's not that expensive, and have a little bit of a barrier, it allows the current members some sense of privacy and security, knowing that we're not just letting in any Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Yeah.
Like, there's a little bit of an onboarding process, a little bit of a weed out for the people that are serious about this. Because this isn't a community to just fuck off and go do recreational every weekend. God bless those that do. This is a community for people that are doing work and are serious about it. And so we wanted to have a little bit of a filter for that.
Yeah. And even you mentioned about trolls, that I think that that's actually a good way of limiting the potential interaction of trolls, because it's one thing if you have a free website that anybody can come and participate and comment on, and then you get the assholes, they show up and like, I just want to trash on you or trash on whatever's going on here. But if someone has to pay a small fee, that I think that's probably going to keep the trolls under the bridge, in a sense that they're going to like, well... I'm not going to pay money to be an asshole. That's something I deliver for free. So.
keep the trolls under the bridge. That's well put. It's a funny thing about the trolls, though, Martin, I don't know if you've seen this, is that there's this Alex Ebert quote. He said, "My enemies turn into my greatest teachers," where I found that the trolls actually, they've given me talking point practice. And that has helped me, like trolls on the internet or whatever on TikTok, has given me talking point practice than in person, to how to handle gracefully. And so in a way, and then I've also found when there are trolls on these comments, that it's kind of like if someone trashes McDonald's to you for, you know, 20 minutes straight, you kind of end up wanting some chicken McNuggets for a second. Yeah. The opposite kind of occurs, and some people have liked us and I think followed us or signed up because of to go anti on the troll. So maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's funny how these things can play out. I don't know. I mean, maybe you want to keep this private, but I'm just curious, how large is the community that's developed around Soiree at this point? I mean, you don't have to give any specific numbers. I mean, I'm not asking for proprietary information, but I'm just curious, like, is it growing? Are people interacting with it? Are they reaping the benefits of what's available?
Yes. So I'm an open book on this kind of stuff. So we launched about 2.5 months ago, and we're now at about, I think, 55 signups and members. So it's still very small and intimate, still figuring it out, but they're engaged. And it feels personal, and it feels like a community. And so it's very much early stages. I have some ideas on the vision, on the next steps that I can expound on if you want. But right now, it's very early in some of the formative members. And in fact, the very first member, her name's Candace. She's an incredible person. I ended up hiring and added her to the team. And so it's that kind of vibe there now. It's a fun new community.
Neat. So, yeah, I've already mentioned some of the things that are on here. Where are you looking to take it? Like, what are your ideas for what those next steps are?
So right now, I think that the way it is, where it's allowing everybody to interact and find a trip buddy, have a safety net, be able to chat and just talk about your trips and maybe do some mushroom growing troubleshooting. That's this current phase where we're at. And it's good with that, actually. Still some polishing that needs to be done, but it's good. The second step is the way that I envision it is kind of like a Peloton for psychedelics, where we really encourage the members to have their own sessions in the dojo. Dojo is like this 3D space where you can kind of move around. Imagine if Zoom and virtual reality had a baby. That's the dojo. And there's private rooms, and there's like a mushroom room. And so we say, hey, Martin, if you're a member, you can lead your own group on the third Monday of every month. And so we encourage them. And we say, look, unabashed, do self-promotion within soiree. It's so hard to find places to promote yourself in psychedelics because of community guidelines and all this other bullshit. And so we say, so that's kind of step two, is getting at a point where, oops, my Siri just responded. So getting to a point where we can have a community where we've got guides, we've got leaders in the space, and they can have sessions, whether it's trip related or integration or anything psychedelic related. And maybe they'll get a little following, and maybe we pay them for being a good contributor. And then long term, if I could wave a magic wand, is down the road, getting to a point where it's automated. And so we could have perhaps maybe 1,000, maybe 10,000, maybe 50,000 people tripping at the same time. And we can have everyone with a wearable device or an Aura ring, perhaps, where you've got some for the people that want medical care. And you could have maybe 4 or 5 doctors on there, and they can, you know, handle anybody that has an issue that flares up. But you've got some diagnostics that are going on mid-trip where you can do it remotely. And you don't require people to fly to Costa Rica or be in a big city. And you can even have vision AI tech where we can make sure you're not having a seizure or you're not trying to leave your place. And so to have it fully scalable and veering into eventually a medical setting.
Oh, well, it sounds very interesting. So I will be curious to hear how it grows. I'm just wondering, with the clientele that you have so far, the members who have joined up, is there any geographical center? I mean, I know that you're down in Southern California. Is it kind of pulling from the LA psychedelic community, or is this branching out into other areas of the world?
Both, actually. So we've got a couple of power members there. One, Lena and Andrew, are doing testimonials on the website. You'll see them. But it's all over. It's all over the country, Canada, UK, Australia, and we are seeing a trend of the demographic, and generally it's 35 to 55, and what we think is the thing, which is healthy but dissatisfied.
People who are looking for something different.
Right. This isn't a mental health clinic. If you're in a bad spot, this isn't the answer. But when you're kind of at baseline, but you know, something feels off or something feels like it's missing. Maybe you've checked some boxes, you've got the house, you got some money, but something still feels missing, or you're looking for the next transition. To shake that dissatisfaction and find some purpose, that seems to be the one of the common markers.
Yeah, and that's something that also gets kind of lost in the over-medicalized approach to psychedelics, where it's the idea that we're here to treat addiction or depression or trauma. And well, what about people who are just looking for something more? That also is a very legitimate use of psychedelics, that, you know, if we're strictly going through the medical therapeutic model, then that kind of misses sort of the more ordinary person, I say, is healthy but dissatisfied, looking for something different. And that's a huge part of why people go to psychedelics, and what they feel they gain from it is a new sense of purpose, a new sense of meaning, a shift in perspective, new experiences, you know, the novelty of it all, that it brings a new lease on life.
Yeah. And it's like there's maybe the first couple trips for those that have never done it can be a little bit of a cleaning out of the closet or degreasing the old noggin when it got a little gunky up there. But I've found that after that, a lot of times, in addition to the purpose and the you know, creativity, there's just a sense of playfulness with it. Where you laugh more. I just read this quote. It's like the famous Zen proverb. It said, when you have reached enlightenment, the only thing left to do is have a good laugh. And it seems like psychedelics kind of brings you there.
Yeah. To that nice cosmic giggle. So I know we don't have too much time left, but I wondered if you could just kind of walk us through a little bit for you what a high dose psilocybin journey entails in terms of like how do you run your own show? How do you like to construct your space? How do you block out your time? Do you have music that you like to listen to? What is the format for you?
So this was trial and error tested over about 100 magic mushroom trips, and I detailed all of it out in the Silo Solo Guide. Also has an extra P, superfluous P on each, for anybody who wants to sign up and get it. Oh, by the way, we have a promo code for your listeners. It's just 50 Martin, 50% off membership for your listeners if you want.
Nice.
And if you sign up, you get the guide, but I'll give you the Cliff Notes version of it. What I like to do is, first off, do it in the morning. That's probably one of the biggest hacks or most important parts for me. Get a good night's sleep if I can. Do it in the morning. No food, nothing else in the morning that can affect it or impact the trip. And then there's essentially a checklist I do where I will take a cold shower. I will do a 5-minute breath work meditation or a 5-minute breath work, then 5 minutes of meditation. Then I will I'll do the final touches on my custom playlist, which I recommend everyone do if you can. And then consume. And as I consume, I will generally at that point have my intention ready, and I will literally shout it to the heavens, to the whoever's listening, spirit guide, whatever, a few times, 3-4 times. Like, by taking this medicine, I will, or by taking this medicine, please show me, ... Then I consume. And after consumption, right after consumption, I will take one hit of cannabis. I found that it completely removes the nausea and the anxiety pocket of 15 minutes. And then the playlist construction I found is almost an art. And so I've broken it into 4 parts: pre-trip, liftoff, cruising altitude, and landing. And to your point about the prep, the pre-trip is I'll have basically 5 to 8 songs that like get me running around, shouting, jumping, dancing like a 10-year-old version of me on a Friday night sleepover with my best friend. Get endorphins flowing, arms up, just get some good vibes going, because I found that as you enter the Stargate portal, the vibe you're in will dictate part of the trip.
Yeah.
And so after I've run around like a, you know, crazy West African voodoo doctor for about 20 minutes, the medicine starts to take effect, and then the playlist will transition to a classical mix of usually Philip Glass or Vitamin String Quartet, no lyrics, and that's when I'll settle in to this nest of pillows and blankets with music on very loud.
And then you're on your way.
Yeah, and then the goal is essentially just stillness as much as possible. Shut down the body, try to quiet the mind, and just go in.
And is there any regimen that you follow afterwards as everything is washed out? I know some people like to journal, some people, you know, like to take notes or start creating art or, you know, go for a walk. Do you have anything on the back end that you like to do that helps bring everything back down to earth?
I'll share what I kind of do, and I'll share one silly thing I just discovered. There's kind of mid-trip or as you're starting to get back to reality, which is when you have to get up to the bathroom, and this is later work, this is 400 level PhD coursework for the trippers, but if you have an eye mask on or just close your eyes, your first time you're going to have to go to the bathroom, it's going to happen at some point, get up and keep your eyes closed and navigate to the bathroom with just sound and touch and get back then to the nest. And it's just, it's hard to explain, but it's a fascinating experience. To your real question about what's the approach at the landing, as I call it, there isn't really anything I do in particular except, you might appreciate this, I see the guitars in your background. I transition from lyric-free classical and introspective music to funky music, gentle, dreamy, yeah, funky music. And I have a bongo, I get my bongo out, and to the extent possible, I start to move. And you got to be gentle because at that point you're like a newborn gazelle on the African plains. But a little bit of dancing, a little bit of the bongos, and just a little bit of singing if I can, and laughing, a lot of laughing, and just, you know, outbursts of silly joy, and do that until you start to feel back to normal.
Nice. So since you mentioned going to the bathroom, I just have to share this little snippet from Kalindi Iyi. This was something that he used to like to say, and maybe you've encountered some of this as well. I've certainly encountered this a lot, where, you know, in giving public talks about psychedelics and stuff like that, that inevitably you have somebody who comes up and says like, "Oh well, I get there on my own, and it's all just very natural. I'm just naturally tapped into these deep psychic levels and stuff like that." And Kalindi Iyi, his attitude was like, "People like that, they don't know what the fuck they're talking about." He's like, "Cause, man, I'm sitting on the toilet. I'm fucking Captain Kirk, and I am zooming at warp speed." He's like, "Don't you fucking tell me that you can do that shit on your own. You need psilocybin to have that kind of experience." But that was his version of like going to the bathroom on a high dose, saying sometimes, you know, you're in there and you know, again, he's working like 30, 40. I think he got up to like 45 grams before he died. And he worked his way up.
How old was he when he died?
I believe he was in his mid 60s.
Because I wonder, with like Terrence McKenna dying young in a way, I wonder if like there is, it becomes a little deleterious with massive doses like that too frequently, maybe, if it's a strain on the brain, perhaps. Well, maybe 60s. It's causation, not correlation.
Yeah, he was definitely a bit older than me. I'm not sure of exact age. And also there was some talk about that it might have been coronavirus, and then some people were saying, no, don't say it was coronavirus. So, I mean, it happened early on in the pandemic that he passed. And so it's, I guess, I don't have the details of exactly what it was. But it's something that he worked on over years, you know, that he started at like 3 grams, then up to 5, and then up to 8. And then, you know, he worked all the way up. But that he used to like to talk about, like, "I'd get lost in the bathroom for like 5 hours, and I'm just out there through, you know, zooming through space." And it's like, so don't tell me you can do that on your own. That, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, I love this idea of, and there's something just strange about the bathroom experience when you're like, I'm in a bathroom and I'm on a heavy dose of psychedelics. That's just, it really, it's tough to describe. Are you saying that he would be, that people come up to him and say that they would get to that level sober?
Yeah.
In a sense? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like, no, you do not get to that level sober. This is not possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you've got like a free-flowing DMT faucet in your neural network circuitry, it's just not possible to get to that.
Yeah. So for yourself, was this a process of working up over the years of increasing the dosage? I mean, going from 5 to 9, how did you get comfortable with that?
Exactly that. And in fact, I was probably in a camp of, No, all you need is 2 to 4 for, you know, for any deep trip, because I've had big blasts off at like 2.8 grams.
Yeah.
And then I started digging in and I saw, no, some people do 9, 10, 20. I've never heard more than 20, this Kundalini guy. That's pretty impressive and bold. But for me, it was, I didn't feel ready for bigger doses until it was probably a few half doses, like 1.75. And then basically 4 years at around 2 to 4, depending on the month. Mm-hmm. And then recently it was my first big one, or the first big leap from that 2 to 4 range to then 9 grams, which was 2 weeks ago.
And how'd that go for you?
Life-changing. I almost didn't think it would be, because I was like, I've done this a million times. No way. I had 3 takeaways. One it's been a tough few years of adversity, and I had a company I built that, you know, didn't make it. And it was as if this like grandfatherly figure, kind of took my hand, like the 9-year-old version of me took my hand and was like, come here, slugger. Let's look at some of the things you did. And I got it was like a museum tour of, It was like a museum tour of some of the things I've done right, things that only I knew about, or, you know, thoughtful decisions and sacrifices. And I've never had anything like that on a trip where it was like, hey, let's look at some of the things you did well lately. And that is meaningful. That's in a way that's hard to put to words. The second takeaway was I was trying to figure out what to do next with my professional career and where to move. And my partner and I are breaking up. She's wonderful, but it's time. And I said, what do I do next? And I just said, my intention was, how do I make the best of this opportunity in front of me? And I got a very clear, it was like a thunderclap from Zeus that hit my head, and it said, move to Medellin. And so I'm moving to Medellin in 2 months to be a digital nomad. And then the third thing was just the sense that, kind of related to the Medellin move, that one thing, one move, one decision, one idea can change everything. And it was like a Count Pierre Bezukhov, like whatever happens next, I know at least things will be different. And the sense that, look, I'm going to go, I don't know what's going to happen in Colombia when I do this digital nomad thing, but it will lead to a butterfly effect. And it's just kind of something comforting about that.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for that openness and that honesty. And, you know, this is just audio, but you teared up a little bit as you're speaking about kind of getting that presentation of things that you had done right in your life. And I just really want to emphasize that, because so often, you know, people explore the dark things and they say, oh, this is something I feel ashamed of, or that this was the time that I was traumatized and I'm, you know, releasing that. And so there's a lot of dark work that people do on mushrooms or psychedelics, but also the celebration of the things that we've done right, that, you know, it kind of goes back again to this idea of being self-serving, in a sense that there is a healthy way of being self-serving. There's a healthy way of being self-supportive and self-congratulatory. And that, I don't know if we really have enough of that in our society, where we celebrate people, that we really love taking people down. We love criticizing people. Mm-hmm. We love, you know, digging up dirt on people, but the celebration and just looking at, oh, here's some beautiful things of your life. Isn't that beautiful? And to give you that sense of, okay, now I'm going to move into something new and I don't know what it's going to be. But if I can look back and see all these beautiful aspects of my life and of my being, that maybe that's going to bring me forward into the next new development. And so there'll be new beautiful things coming, even though there's uncertainties and hardships and all of that. So I just want to celebrate that. It's really beautiful. So thank you for sharing and just opening your heart to that and letting yourself show that.
That's so beautifully put, Martin. And I feel like it's the word and the connotation around psychedelics sometimes feels like a microcosm of news in general, where you hear the bad news,
yeah,
and you don't hear the beautiful stories, where, you know, if I had to put it at a percentage, I would say maybe 3% of my deep trips were like work and working through some cobwebs or whatever. And those are also just the first two or three. And the 98%, 97% remaining have been illuminating and blissful and joyful and playful. And it's like, that doesn't get as much of a headline and actually, Martin, if you don't mind me doing this, so I do this on our show where it's probably it's kind of the piece de resistance of the Psychedelic Diaries, which is because you got me to open up. If you don't mind sharing one transcendent or profound experience that you've had that is still meaningful for you.
Oh, man. Gosh, what to pick from? Oh, my goodness. Oh, man, I'm okay. So this is a very minor thing, but actually it really stands out, and I guess I'm pulling from it because it's a bit more recent. It's not a big thing. It's not a huge thing, but for me, it was really kind of emblematic of just really how connected and alive everything really is in a way that it can be counterintuitive. Okay, so this was maybe a year or two ago now. Actually, it was probably about 2 years ago, or maybe a year and a half. Anyway, I had just recently completed recording a new album worth of music. And one of the things that I like to do after I've completed a new collection of music is I like to spend some time tripping and listening to the music and just seeing, you know, what does that bring up for me? And that's always a very interesting experience because whenever I listen to my own music tripping, I hear things that I never would have heard before. And I've even been in states where I'm tripping so hard and I'm listening to my own music and I don't even recognize it, that I don't even know like what's coming next. And it's like, this is like something I'm hearing for the very first time. I mean, literally, I know intellectually this is my music, but I don't know what this is. It's totally unfamiliar to me. So anyway, I was listening to my latest album at the time, and it was a mix of MDMA and mushrooms, I believe. And anyway, I'm sorry?
If you don't mind sharing, how much?
Oh, I'm never an exact measurer. so
fascinating about this mix of the two.
Yeah.
Right, psilocybin MDMA mix. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's quite all right. Yeah, I'm the kind of person who has a nice little bag of pure MDMA and I lick my finger and I put it in there. You know, so I don't.
We should hang out more often.
Yeah, I don't work with scales and stuff like that. And it was like, you know, a handful of mushrooms that have been ground up and put into capsules. I'm not quite sure. And usually, when I do like to trip, I like to go for multiple rounds. So it's like, I'm ready to go deeper. Okay, let's go deeper. And it's funny because it also changes my voice. And so I started getting deeper and deeper and deeper as I go deeper. Anyway, so I'm listening to this. Oh, I didn't give you the backstory. Sorry. So I work on Mac. Okay. I record my music in Logic. And then once I bounce a song out of Logic, it goes into iTunes, and then it should immediately populate onto my phone, onto my playlist. And the last song wasn't going. Every other song in the album was on my phone because I wanted to lie in my bedroom listening to on my phone and my headphones, but I couldn't get the song on my phone. And I even tried uploading it to Dropbox and then downloading it. So I tried all these ways like to get the song and it wasn't working. So I had to settle for, okay, I'm sitting in my office chair, tripping, listening on my computer because I can't get into my bedroom and listen on the headphones. And so I'd been listening to the album like all night long, just having this great time, just absolutely fantastic time. But there was something about the last song that was kind of bugging me. So on the third listen through of the album, I listened to the last song three times. And what came to me is that the song was built around this little piano riff. And the last note of the piano riff, I'm listening to it, and it's like, I hit that note too hard. And when I realized that, it was like, that's it. That's the problem. That's why the song is not populating to my phone, because I hit that note too hard. Now, this is completely counter any form of rationality, right? Why would the technology not work just because I hit this song, this one note too hard? So here I am. It's midnight. you know, it's like I should be like transitioning and going to sleep. But by this point, I was like, no, no, this is it. So I open up Logic and I go in. So it was all done on a MIDI keyboard. So I was able to just slide the pressure key down, slide it down. It was like up at 100 and I slid it down to about 80. And I listened to like, okay, that note is just right. And I was like, this is going to work. This song is going to show up on my phone within 1 second. And I bounced it down. Bing. There it was on my phone. And wow. It was like, I was just, you know, going back to like the giggles, I was laughing so hard. And I was just, I couldn't wait until the morning when I could tell my wife about this. It was like, because this was so funny, because I was so frustrated during the day. It's like, oh, this is going to ruin my trip, or, you know. But then it just came down to, you know what? It's just this note. And it's because the whole system knew the song actually was not ready yet, that I needed mm-hmm. to fix that note. And as soon as I fixed it, and just that there was this excitement, because I knew, you know, as I'm sliding it down, I was like, I know this is going to work. And then another part of me is like, that's so irrational, that this is not the problem. And I was like, no, this is it. I know this is it. And then when it worked, it was just like, yep. And so for me, it's kind of an example of one of the things that I've learned about my psychedelic experiences is really just to trust them, just trust, and especially trust your intuition, trust what you're feeling. And this was just a beautiful example of that, and just how connected really everything is, and that even our technology, it's actually all part of the same universal consciousness that is just interacting with itself through the guises of computers and people and trees and dogs and books and phones and air and light. And it's all just one.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. And I totally agree. It's people say you go to nature and that's the way you can see the world, the universe responding to you. But I think technology is another way it can. Where these, like, you know, interconnected, non-dual messages can get through.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I believe it.
Yeah.
That's why I let the song through.
Yeah. Well, it's been really awesome speaking with you today, Ray. And I'll kind of leave you with a little nugget of, I haven't arranged the interview yet, but a friend sent the book of another friend for me to read and bring on to the podcast. So I'm reading this book right now. And it's about someone who likes to do high dose psilocybin sessions, but sending people through highly choreographed rituals with very specific emotionally triggering playlists. And he does this with people where they take upwards of 5 grams of mushrooms and then go through this psychomagical ritual performance. And he's called it the David Bowie Cabaret, or the David Bowie Magic Cabaret, or something like that. I forget the exact name, but that'll be coming up on the podcast in the coming weeks and months. So you might be interested in that.
What's really, the guest?
His name is Sean Manso. We haven't even talked about bringing him on for an interview yet, but I'm about 2/3 of the way through his book. And I'm just thinking like, wow, that's really something. I mean, it's one thing to take high dose and lie down and have your experience, but the idea that you're going through a choreographed ritual cabaret performance, and everybody else is too, on a high dose of mushrooms. Sounds interesting.
I dig it. What's the book?
It's called AP. Oh, let me grab it. So the book is AP Psychedelics: Going Beyond Set and Setting to Achieve Visionary Virtuosity by Sean Manso.
AP Psychedelics. I dig that name. Like AP History in high school kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. Like Advanced Placement. Yeah.
And it's good. I'll check it out.
Yeah, and it's all about getting beyond the terror, getting beyond the complete loss of control, and focusing on achieving highly resonant emotional states across the spectrum while having to perform specific tasks with a crew of people tripping very hard at the same time. And that he's describing this as a psychomagical tool for learning how to bend without breaking.
Like oxygen mask training, but with psychedelics. I dig that. I'm going to check it out. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Ray, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to chat with you and to share stories and to get to know you and to hear all about Soiree and about the Psychedelic Diaries podcast. And just to remind everyone, it's Soiree, Soiree.com. And you can find links to the Psychedelic Diaries there. And you can join up as a member. And you can use the promo code of 50Martin. And you can get 50% off your signing up over at Soiree for all of you high-dose psilocybin voyagers out there.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Well, have a great day.